Welcome to AgriPulse Newsmakers, where we aim to take you to the heart of ag policy. I'm Spencer Chase. Our guest this week is National Council of Farmer Cooperatives President and CEO Chuck Connor, who joins us to discuss the organization's views on immigration, climate, and more. But first, here's this week's headlines. In efforts to give Roundup its day in front of the Supreme Court suffered a setback this week. The U.S. Solicitor General backed a legal argument that has been used to award millions of dollars to plaintiffs who claim exposure to the glyphosate in Roundup caused their illnesses. The federal government's top lawyer offered the analysis at the request of Supreme Court justices. The High Court is weighing whether or not to reconsider a lower court ruling that found Monsanto failed to adequately warn a California man of the health risks of the product. Bayer, which bought Monsanto in 2018, says it still hopes the Supreme Court will hear its challenge to a Ninth Circuit ruling and overturn the $25 million payments to the plaintiff. The Department of Agriculture says it received 450 applications for funding through the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities program. Those applications ask for between $5 and $100 million each and come from 350 groups across the entire country. The program seeks to invest $1 billion for pilot projects to create new market opportunities for producers selling climate-smart commodities. USDA plans to award funding for the first round of applications this summer. Submissions for smaller proposals between $250,000 and $5 million are due June 10th. And finally, new figures on the state of food price inflation came out this week. According to the latest Consumer Price Index from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, food prices jumped 1% in April and were driven by increases in the costs for chicken, dairy, and eggs. A highly pathogenic avian influenza outbreak has death losses approaching 40 million birds and egg prices up 10.3%. Overall, inflation is moderating, but to a minimal degree. The 12-month CPI was up 8.3% in April, a slight dip from the 8.5% annual increase reported 1 month earlier. Chuck Connor leads the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives and its nearly 2,000 farmer co-ops. He says for his members, inflation is top of mind.
Well, there's no question that this has been ongoing for a while, and it really began for my membership in a big way last fall as they were beginning to put in place their production tools for the 2022 crop and noticed that the price of inputs, fertilizer, even to some extent seed and herbicide had gone up in price dramatically from what they had paid for their 2021 crop. And so farmers were some of the first to see the fact that just putting a crop in the ground this year was going to have a huge inflationary component to it. Obviously, that's getting reflected now in food prices on a number of different fronts, and we're just seeing it across the board. But we were sort of that early canary in the mine, if you will, and seeing it hit us early in this process.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, you mentioned some of the price concerns that your members started kind of reporting to you. Is that the bigger issue that they're facing? Is availability also a big concern? Does one outweigh the other necessarily?
Well, it depends upon the timing that you're talking about. For 2022 and the production of that crop, there was some initial concern on the part of our supplier members as well as the farmers, but that was worked through pretty quickly. And for the most part, everything that a producer is needing out there this spring to put that crop in the ground is available to them. They may not like the price, but it is available. Now, when you talk about next year, that's availability becomes a very prominent issue at that point. And we're nervous about that. And we're working feverishly with our partners in USDA and on Capitol Hill and others in trying to explore every alternative that we can out there to make sure that we sort of remove obstacles to supply availability next year, because that's when we really are fearful at this point.
And as your members and producers alike facing sort of these twin issues of, you know, input availability, input prices, and inflation as a whole, the Biden administration has taken some steps. We saw the president go to Illinois this week to announce doubling of that domestic fertilizer production capability, effort that USDA has. But generally speaking, has the administration done enough here?
Well, I don't think in these kind of circumstances you can ever do enough. These are dramatic, game-changing kind of things that we really have not seen in my professional life, and have to go back to my early days as a boy in the early 1970s to sort of see anything comparable to what we're doing now. So you can't really get ahead of this, and I suspect we're going to see a lot more announcements coming out of the Biden administration. Yesterday, I expressed appreciation to Secretary Vilsack and to the Biden administration for the efforts that they have made. Now, that doesn't necessarily translate into a belief from me or my organization that these things are going to have a dramatic effect at this point. Some of these things are just going to require time, and we're going to have to work our way through. But nevertheless, they're important policy decisions that we appreciate the speed at which the Department of Agriculture and others have brought these forward, and they're worthy of us saying positive things at this point, even though we have to acknowledge that they're probably not going to reverse this inflationary course and this course of potential short supply that we are on.
We'll be right back to talk immigration, climate, and more with NCFC's Chuck Connor right after this.
Regenerative poultry production is a process by which nature can actually recapture and restore the energy that is being taken out of our space.
Farm Credit helped Rahi build his dream of regenerative poultry farming and encouraging fellow immigrants to find community in agriculture.
Nothing beats a farm. I'm just pursuing happiness.
Learn more at farmcredit.com/beginning.
Welcome back. Immigration reform has been a top priority for many organizations in farm policy, including the National Council of Farmer Cooperatives. Their president and CEO, Chuck Connor, says their group supports the Farm Workforce Modernization Act and would like to see some Senate action on the House-passed legislation.
Well, we've got to get the Senate to act, basically. This is a frustrating circumstance because we know what needs to happen here. We know what needs to be done. A lot of the problems we discussed today in terms of inflation and the economy and things like that, there's a difference of opinion in terms of what should be done. There's no difference of opinion here in our ag immigration space on what needs to be done. We know what needs to be done. We just need to convince lawmakers, and in this case, lawmakers in the Senate, to step up to the plate and do what they know needs to be done to solve this labor problem, which has become extremely acute in the last several months for American agriculture, literally at a time where we've got shortages across the globe as a result of the Ukrainian situation. We are going to leave crops in America unharvested because we don't have the laborers to do it, and that's just so wrong on so many different fronts. We need to fix this problem. We need the Senate to take up the House passed bill. Doesn't mean they have to do it exactly as the House did, but debate this and have an honest and open dialogue. Let's work these things out. Again, everyone knows what needs to be done here at the end of the day. We just got to step forward, and we hope the Senate is willing to do this before the end of the year, because it is badly needed in order to solve the longstanding labor problem, but certainly to solve this immediate food crisis that we are confronting every day in the grocery store.
Well, and you lead me into my next question then, because you talk about wanting to see the Senate act at some point before the end of the year. Based on conversations you're having with Capitol Hill, is that something that's on the table? Is that compromise achievable, or is this something that that you're already preparing to see get punted into the next Congress?
Well, we always have to have hope in these circumstances, and I'm a veteran of the legislative process, and I know that getting the Senate to act on a controversial issue in a midterm election year, an important midterm election year, is tough. And so you can't put great odds on it, but at the same time, too, you know, we're in a different circumstance now than we have in the past when we've been trying to debate this. I mean, there is truly a food crisis on this planet. And for the first time, really, in maybe two, perhaps three generations, we've got Americans actually questioning whether or not, you know, our own food supply here in America is going to be adequate and, you know, to supply our needs. And that's a game changer for us. Labor is a key part of that. And, you know, when we're talking about solutions, which, again, are being rolled out every day, potential solutions, the one solution that we know will work in this is an increase in labor supply in agriculture today so that we can get these crops harvested, get these livestock tended to in an orderly and efficient way. And that's going to increase our food supply. And that's exactly what the market needs to see today.
Mm-hmm. Chuck, before I let you go, I want to talk about some climate news, some climate issues that we've seen here this week, especially given your role on that Food and Agriculture Climate Alliance. We saw the Department of Agriculture announce this week 450 applications for that first round of funding on the Partnerships for Climate Smart Commodities program. Obviously, there's a lot of interest there with that level of participation. Some of those grants up to $100 million. USDA's got about $1 billion to work with here. And there's a second round of applications coming between like $250,000 and $5 million. I wonder, do you think this is a program that could potentially use some more funding now? Or is this a situation where maybe have USDA get a little bit more footing underneath itself, establish a program a little bit better, and add more funding later? Your thoughts on that subject?
Well, I think I come down in the camp of really appreciating the effort that has been put forward so far. I'm not surprised that, you know, we're sort of oversubscribed in this. That's pretty typical of these programs. But even with it being oversubscribed, I would argue for a more cautious approach here, and that is let's get some money working out there and evaluate how well this is going before we throw a whole lot more dollars at this. And I'm not saying we've hit the exact sweet spot where we are now, but I'm not sure I would advocate for big new spending, big new program initiatives here until we see the practical application of seeing these dollars being put in place on the ground out there. It's so important that we get this right. If we don't get it right, you know, we've set back this notion of climate smart agriculture and it being a positive thing for American agriculture. You know, we've got to keep that fundamental principle going. And in order to do that, I encourage a steady and evaluative sort of process here and not get too carried away just out of our enthusiasm for this type of program.
Mm-hmm. And wrapping things up here, Chuck, obviously the 2023 Farm Bill right around the corner, hearings on that have already taken place. But do you think this program is maybe a little bit late in the game to perhaps inform some of the conversation that could come into that 2023 Farm Bill? I mean, the practices we might not know the results of, but might have a better picture of you know, funding needs. Your thoughts on this program and how it might intersect with that Farm Bill?
Well, the timing, I don't know, is exactly perfect on this, but I have said on numerous occasions, I think climate is going to be a very, very fundamental part of this next Farm Bill debate. Some have suggested a climate title. I don't know if that's appropriate or not, but clearly, I believe that in order to have a bipartisan Farm Bill in 2023, you're going to have to be able to claim that it's the most climate-friendly Farm Bill that we have passed in the history of this country. I think it's got to be that way. I think it should be that way, again, given the fact that we have, through our Climate Alliance, identified a lot of initiatives that are not only good for the climate, but good for the farmers. So, you know, what can go wrong there, really, in that circumstance? We ought to be aggressive in pushing those, whether that's, you know, by other means or through the Farm Bill as well. But at the end of the day, this Farm Bill is going to have to do a lot for climate one way or the other in order, I think, to get the sort of bipartisan support that it needs to go forward out there.
Very good. Well, we've covered inflation, immigration, climate, the Farm Bill. I'm not sure what other boxes we could check here in this time of a conversation. But Chuck, appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me on today.
We'll be right back to discuss this week's news with our panel. But first, we talked about immigration legislation with NCFC's Chuck Connor. Now, our Hannah Pagel takes a look at enforcement of existing immigration law in this week's Ag by the Numbers.
Farm workers in the United States earn some of the lowest wages in the labor market and experience an above average rate of workplace injuries. The Wage and Hour Division at the Department of Labor enforces laws like the Fair Labor Standards Act and the Migrant and Seasonal Agricultural Worker Protection Act, and oversees programs like the H-2A Guest Worker Program. But since the Bush administration, investigations of farm employers have decreased. According to an analysis conducted by the Economic Policy Institute, the Wage and Hour Division conducted more than 31,000 investigations in U.S. agriculture between fiscal years 2000 and 2019. That's roughly 1,500 investigations per year. Through those investigations, the Wage and Hour Division ordered $76 million to be paid in back wages to 154,000 farm workers. A main contributor of the decrease in investigations is due to a lack of funding to the Wage and Hour Division. In inflation-adjusted dollars, the Wage and Hour Division's budget in 2020 was $13 million less than it was in 2012. In addition to a lack of funding, the number of investigators has also decreased. In 2019, there were only 780 investigators enforcing federal labor standards, which is even fewer than in 1973. The Economic Policy Institute notes in their analysis, in 1978, there was one Wage and Hour Division investigator for every 69,000 U.S. workers. But by 2018, there was one investigator for every 175,000 U.S. workers. Looking at this chart, we can see that the number of investigations significantly dropped off during the Trump administration. Enforcement figures updated through the end of March show ag investigations are proceeding about the same pace as in fiscal year 2021. The Biden administration is trying to hire more investigators and ramp up its enforcement, but those efforts may be hampered by the lack of a confirmed administrator for the Wage and Hour Division. Steve Davies has a deeper look at the challenges facing the division and its enforcement in his story on AgriPulse.com. For this week's Ag by the Numbers, I'm Hannah Pagel.
Farmers are always there for each other. We shed tears together. We celebrate together. But we also grow together. Farm Bureau is the largest general farm organization in the country. We have the farmers' back. If you're a farmer and you're not a member, we would welcome you into our Farm Bureau family. And if you want to know more about agriculture, come be part of this great family.
Welcome back to AgriPulse Newsmakers. Glad to be joined by a panel of experts to discuss this week's news. Really a wide-ranging topic of conversation. Going to be talking immigration, climate, as well as inflation. And happy to be joined this week by Ricky Volpe, a food price economist with Cal Poly, Dave Gagner with the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation, and joining us in studio this week, Allison Crittenden with the American Farm Bureau Federation. And Ricky, I want to go to you first because we saw the CPI figures come out this week, inflation moderating a little bit this week, but not by a lot. Wondering, based on your analysis, based on what you're seeing on food prices, is there relief coming for consumers?
In the sense that inflation is not sustainable at the level it's at right now, yes. I think, you know, all the signs that I'm seeing are pointing to 2022 being a really hard year, with inflation, food price inflation ending up being about double what it's been historically for the last, say, 20, 25 years. So consumers will feel that. I personally see no reason why it should be higher than 2.5-3% for calendar year 2023. But you know, that's going to be cold comfort for a lot of households, because remember, that doesn't mean food prices are coming down. It means inflation's coming down. You know, just the general nature of the changing value of the U.S. dollar means it's rare to see deflation. But these high food prices aren't really going anywhere. Our best hope is that inflation will moderate, slow down, and within a year or two get back down to that 2-2.5% annual average, which is normal.
So we've seen the CPI go down from about 8.5% in March to 8.3% in April. Was that the peak, do you think? I mean, should we expect a continued trend down, or is it too early to tell at this point?
It's so what's going on internationally is a major complicating factor. I don't think anybody really knows what's exactly going to happen to food prices. I think we're all hopeful that we've seen the peak of food price inflation. Obviously, there's been a lot going on, and it's just worth pointing out that the food supply chain continues to face a lot of structural challenges that existed before COVID, and we're still dealing with them. Trucks are hard to come by. Truck rates are high. We have labor shortages and high labor turnover and all that. But one of the reasons why I think we're seeing inflation moderating is because I do think that the food supply chain, by and large, production, harvesting, processing, manufacturing, retailing, have largely adjusted to the impacts of COVID or moved over it wherever they can. So we're starting to see some moderating factors there. That said, the war in Ukraine is going to continue to put pressure on a lot of our commodities, our oils, our wheat. It's going to continue to slow things down at the ports, make overseas transportation more expensive. And this drought in the West, we're just getting into the dry season now, and everyone's worried about fruit and vegetable prices, but alfalfa prices are up, and that's going to increase the inflationary pressure on all of our meats and dairies and everything. So have we seen the worst of it? Based on what I can see and measure, I do think so. But inflation is not going anywhere for 2022.
Mm-hmm. And Allison, bringing you into the fold here, one of the things that Ricky mentioned was driving food prices was the labor shortage and trying to adjust to that. One area that some folks point to as a possible avenue to address that labor shortage is the Farm Workforce Modernization Act. Now, Farm Bureau is taking a different position on that bill than many other ag organizations. What is driving that stance that has Farm Bureau in opposition to the stance taken by many other farm groups?
Well, I think a lot of farm groups recognize that the bill that passed in the House is not perfect. And in these Senate conversations, we're all seeking changes to that House passed bill. But Farm Bureau's main concerns center around the Title II of the bill, which are most of the H-2A provisions. One of those big things is the methodology for the adverse effect wage rate. That's the wage rate that if you're a farmer and you're hiring H-2A workers, you have to pay it. Probably a factor contributing to some of this inflation, too, are our increasing labor expenses. You know, when you look at how much the AWER has grown over the last 5 years, it's grown 20%. And at the same time, actually, our cash receipts for fruits and vegetables are down somewhere between 16 to 19% over that same five-year span. So that's one of the big issues that we hope to address in the Senate in an ag labor reform package.
So officially, as we sit here right now, I know this is a bit of Washington nuance, but does Farm Bureau oppose this bill or not support it?
We do not support it. There's a bit of a nuance there. We want to see ag labor reform happen. But our withholding of support for Farm Workforce Modernization Act is a recognition that this is an imperfect bill and there are major things that need to be addressed should it move forward in the Senate.
Mm-hmm. I want to pivot to climate here, Dave, because obviously we saw the Department of Agriculture make the announcement that 450 applications requesting funding for that Climate Smart Partnerships program. There's $1 billion there, applications up to $100 million. I went to a state school and I wasn't a math major there. I can't imagine that that everybody's gonna be happy at the end of this deal. But I wonder, do you anticipate USDA will fund fewer programs at partial funding more programs at partial funding or fewer programs at full funding?
I'm gonna go back. The history of anything that's even remotely looked like this thing is they're gonna end up cutting, they're gonna award more at a lesser amounts. It's just they don't have a choice. With that many, they're gonna have a lot of great proposals in there. I know my organization, we were part of a number of partnerships that submitted, but 450, the secretary supposedly had come out and said there was $4 billion. I actually hear that number is double that in total dollars submitted for. So let's just go with $8 billion worth of submittals. You're gonna have to cut and paste and see what people are willing to work with. The best example of how that's worked in the past is the RCPP program. And as an awardee of those, we've almost never gotten what we asked for. We've gotten a lesser amount on most of those proposals. So I think that's what they're gonna have to do if they're gonna meet demand a little bit and satisfy all the different organizations and groups and communities that are out there. Key situation for them.
We'll be right back to talk more immigration, climate, and inflation with our panel right after this.
Looking closer, seeing further. That's how we do it. At Curious Plot, we're driven to find what's next for agriculture, animal care, and food. We stay curious because that's what it takes to grow understanding. That's how we plot strategies and tell stories that get results time after time. Marketing, communications, and consulting that look closer and see further. Curious Plot. We can't wait to help you tell your story.
Welcome back. Our panelists may be covering a wide variety of farm policy topics, but they say they're all watching a variety of short-term indicators for long-term signals.
We really are at a crisis point when it comes to our ag labor needs and the workforce shortage that we're facing, the rising costs to use the H-2A program. We really can't afford to keep kicking the can down the road. I am a bit more optimistic now than I was a few weeks ago, seeing some of the news reports that there are bipartisan conversations taking place to address issues at our southern border. And I'm hoping that in those bipartisan conversations, we can also create a pathway in which we can see ag labor reform happen as well.
So you think it's not necessarily a matter where this immigration bill will be separated from the southern border conversations, but can move in concert with it?
Perhaps, yes. I think, ag, we are a strong lobby. We have a lot of constituents throughout the country. And if we're able to get a bill that we can all rally around and support, and something else is moving within immigration, hopefully we can work hard in D.C. here for our members back home and get something done.
Well, and Ricky, when Allison talks about her members back home, they're among the same group of folks that are paying more for food prices, dealing with that inflation. The Biden administration has taken some steps to address inflationary pressure, as well as folks, the inflationary pressure facing at the grocery store. But do you think there's more available to the administration to do to address, food price inflation specifically?
Short-term solutions to address food price inflation are really hard to come by. I'm actually much more interested in having conversations about what are long-term solutions and investments that can be made that are going to quote-unquote future-proof the food supply chain. So I would like to see public-private partnerships, investments, innovation, funding funneled towards things like vertical farming, things like automation, things like self-driving trucks, these things that are going to help to alleviate these choke points that we're currently facing the food supply chain that aren't going anywhere. And, it's probably obvious to everyone on the call, but, keeping international trade for food at all levels of the food supply chain is key. I mean, over time, as we've increased our global food supply network, we've seen, the supply curve shift out and food prices go down. So those are the steps I'd like to continue to see us move in. But in terms of anything that's going to help food price inflation moderate before the end of 2022, I don't think anybody has any great ideas on that.
Mm-hmm. Which is obviously not the news a lot of American consumers want to hear, but the unfortunate reality facing the situation. Dave, I want to wrap things up with you. We talked about the concerns facing the Department of Agriculture as it looks to allocate this climate smart funding, but we have to keep in mind also there's a second round of applications out there coming for those projects between the $250,000 and $5 million ballpark. Do you have any concern about the amount of funding that's going to be available for that round of applications based on the funding that we've seen for those $5 to $100 million projects?
No, in all honesty, I think they already broke those dollars out. From what I've understood from conversations with folks at the department, that's all separated. What I think the department's more interested in talking about is, do they do another round of both? Do they wait until October 1? Do we need appropriate, I know it's not tied to appropriations, but do they wait for appropriations to get done? Do they do this prior to the fall elections? Honestly, I think there's going to be another round of this, and we're going to have another $1 billion out because there's a heck of a lot of proposals.
So you say you expect another round of proposals. Are you a brave enough man to handicap when you think that announcement will take place?
Honest to goodness, I would expect this. I'd expect something in October.
Obviously, a lot of ground covered. We talked climate, we talked immigration, and we talked food prices. A number of topics of importance to the American consumer and the American producer right now. And Ricky, Allison, and Dave, we appreciate you stopping by to join us to discuss them all. We'll be right back with more newsmakers. But first, AgriPulse's Hannah Pagel takes a look at the popularity of a farm bill program in this week's Map It Out.
The Department of Agriculture is considering making changes to the Whole Farm Revenue Protection Program, helping to increase the appeal of a product that allows farmers to insure their entire operation under a single policy. The program was authorized in the 2014 Farm Bill after succeeding the Adjusted Gross Revenue Program that dates back to 2008. But in recent years, Whole Farm has seen a decline in enrollment. Before we get to why, let's break down what the program is. The Whole Farm Revenue Program is a crop insurance product that offers producers nationwide the option to insure the revenue of their entire operation, including crop, livestock, and nursery production, under a single policy. It was designed to appeal to small and mid-sized farms and help encourage other operations to add additional crops or livestock in ways that might seem too risky without insurance. Sales of the Whole Farm Program have fallen every year since peaking in 2017, with over 2,800 policies. This year, more than 1,800 policies have been sold, with 712 of them being purchased in the state of Washington. That's according to the latest weekly report posted by USDA's Risk Management Agency. To learn more about the barriers facing the program, check out Amy Mayer's story on AgriPulse.com. For this week's Map It Out, I'm Hannah Pegel.
Did you know AgriPulse has all your favorite podcasts, including Open Mic, Newsmakers, and Drive Time? Take us wherever you go. Subscribe at AgriPulse.com or on Spotify, Google Play, or Apple Podcasts.
Agriculture Future of America is a nonprofit building transformational leaders in food and agriculture. AFA prepares college students to join the workforce as innovative and engaged young professionals who will shape the future of agriculture. Head to agfuture.org to find out how you can get involved.
Thanks again for tuning in for another episode of AgriPulse Newsmakers. Before we let you go, here's what's on the horizon for the week to come. A Senate Appropriations Subcommittee will hear testimony from the Biden administration on the budget request for the Environmental Protection Agency on Wednesday. Then on Thursday, the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee is set to look into the funding of the Department of the Interior. As it often goes in farm policy, there's almost certain to be more news and developments that will unfold, and we'll keep a close eye on it all at AgriPulse.com. For AgriPulse Newsmakers, I'm Spencer Chase. Have a good one.
Newsmakers is a production of AgriPulse Communications. For more ag policy news, visit AgriPulse.com. You can also find our new content on YouTube and wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to follow AgriPulse and our correspondents on social media to get breaking news and more.